coming to bring back your friend," I said, placing a second note on top of the first. His eyes never left the money. "And anyway, who knows? He might just have done a bunk for a few days. That wouldn't be considered unusual in his line of work." I placed a third note on top of the second. "And when he comes back, your mates will never let you forget it." A fourth note was followed by a fifth. "And you wouldn't want to be charged with wasting the police's time, would you? That's a serious offence, for which you can go to jail." Two more notes. "And, of course, you'd also lose your job." He looked up at me, his anger visibly turning to fear. Three more notes. "I could hardly be expected to employ a man who was accusing me of murder." I placed the last two notes on top of the pile. The envelope was empty. Tangkok turned away. I took out my wallet and added one more £5 note, £3.10, to the pile. £68.10 in all. His eyes returned to the notes. "There's plenty more where that came from," I said, hoping I sounded convincing. Tangkok walked slowly towards my desk, and without looking at me, gathered up the notes, stuffed them into his pocket, and left without a word. I went to the window and watched as he walked out of the building and headed slowly for the dock gate. I left the safe wide open, scattered some of its contents on the floor, dropped the empty envelope on my desk, and left my office without locking up. I was the last person to leave the building. Chapter 21. "Detective Inspector Blakemore, sir," said Miss Potts, then stood aside to allow the policeman to enter the managing director's office. Hugo Barrington studied the inspector carefully as he entered the room. He couldn't have been much more than the regulation minimum height of 5 feet 9 inches, and he was a few pounds overweight, but still looked fit. He was carrying a raincoat that had probably been bought when he was still a constable, and wore a brown felt hat of a more recent vintage, indicating that he hadn't been an inspector all that long. The two men shook hands, and once he was seated, Blakemore took a notebook and pen out of an inside jacket pocket. "As you know, sir, I am following up inquiries concerning an alleged theft that took place on these premises last night." Barrington didn't like the word "alleged." "Could I begin by asking when you first discovered that the money was missing?" "Yes, of course, Inspector," said Barrington, trying to sound as helpful as possible. "I arrived at the docks around 7 o'clock this morning and drove straight to the sheds to check how the night shift had got on."
"Is that something you do every morning?"
"No, only from time to time," said Hugo, puzzled by the question.
"And how long did you spend there?"
20, perhaps 30 minutes, then I came up to my office."
"So you would have been in your office at around 7:20, 7:30 at the latest?"
"Yes, that sounds about right."
"And was your secretary already here by then?"
"Yes, she was. I rarely managed to get in before her. She's a formidable lady," he added with a smile.
"Quite," said the detective inspector.
"So it was Miss Potts who told you the safe had been broken into?"
"Yes. She said that when she came in this morning, she found the safe door open and some of its contents scattered on the floor, so she immediately rang the police."
"She didn't ring you first, sir?"
"No, Inspector, I would have been in my car on the way to work at that time."
"So you say your secretary arrived before you this morning, and did you leave before her last night, sir?"
"I don't recall," said Barrington, "but it would be most unusual for me to leave after her."
"Yes, Miss Potts has confirmed that,"
said the detective inspector. "But she also said," he glanced down at his notebook, "I left before Mr. Barrington last night as a problem had arisen which needed his attention." Blakemore looked up. "Are you able to tell me what that problem was, sir?"
"When you run a company as large as this," said Hugo, "problems arise all the time."
"So you don't remember what particular problem arose yesterday evening?"
"No, Inspector, I do not."
"When you arrived in your office this morning and found the safe door open, what was the first thing you did?"
"I checked to see what was missing."
"And what did you discover?"
"All my cash had been taken."
"How can you be sure it had all been taken?"
"Because I found this open envelope on my desk," Hugo said, handing it over.
"And how much should there have been in the envelope, sir?"
£68.10.
"You seem very certain of that."
"Yes, I am," said Hugo. "Why should that surprise you?"
"It's simply that Miss Potts told me there was only £60 in the safe, all in £5 notes. Perhaps you could tell me, sir, where the other £8.10 came from."
Hugo didn't answer immediately.
"I do sometimes keep a little loose change in my desk drawer, Inspector," he said finally.
"That's quite a large sum to describe as a little loose change. However, allow me to return to the safe for a moment. When you entered your office this morning, the first thing you noticed was that the safe door was open."
"That is correct, Inspector."
"Do you have a key for the safe?"
"Yes, of course."
"Are you the only person who knows the code and is in possession of a key, sir?"
"No, Miss Potts also has access to the safe."
"Can you confirm that the safe was locked when you went home last night?"
"Yes, it always is."
"Then we must assume that the burglary was carried out by a professional."
"What makes you say that, Inspector?" asked Barrington.
"But if he was a professional," said Blakemore, ignoring the question, "what puzzles me is why he left the safe door open."
"I'm not sure I'm following you, Inspector."
"I'll explain, sir.
Professional burglars tend to leave everything just as they found it, so that their crime won't be found out immediately. It allows them more time to dispose of the stolen goods."
"More time?" repeated Hugo.
"A professional would have closed the safe door and taken the envelope with him, making it more likely that it would be some time before you discovered anything was missing. In my experience, some people don't open their safes for days, even weeks. Only an amateur would have left your office in such disarray."
"Then perhaps it was an amateur."
"Then how did he manage to open the safe, sir?"
"Maybe he somehow got hold of Miss Potts' key."
"And the code as well?"
"But Miss Potts assures me that she takes her safe key home every night, as I understand you do, sir."
Hugo said nothing.
"May I be allowed to look inside the safe?"
"Yes, of course."
"What is that?" asked the inspector, pointing to a tin box on the bottom shelf of the safe.
"It's my coin collection, Inspector. A hobby of mine."
"Would you be kind enough to open it, sir?"
"Is that really necessary?" asked Hugo impatiently.
"Yes, I'm afraid it is, sir."
Hugo reluctantly opened the box to reveal a hoard of gold coins he had collected over many years.
"Now here's another mystery," said the inspector.
"Our thief takes £60 from the safe and £8.10 from your desk drawer, but leaves behind a box of gold coins that must be worth considerably more. And then there's the problem of the envelope."
"The envelope?" said Hugo.
"Yes, sir. The envelope you say contained the money."
"But I found it on my desk this morning."
"I don't doubt that, sir. But you will notice that it has been slit neatly open."
"Probably with my letter opener," said Hugo, holding it up triumphantly.
"Quite possibly, sir. But in my experience, burglars have a tendency to rip open envelopes, not slit them neatly with a letter opener, as if they already knew what was inside.
"But Miss Potts told me that you'd found the thief," said Hugo, trying not to sound exasperated.
"No, sir. We have found the money, but I'm not convinced that we found the guilty party."
"But you found some of the money in his possession."
"Yes, we did, sir."
"Then what more do you want?"
"To be certain we've got the right man."
"And who is the man you've charged?"
"I didn't say I charged him, sir," said the inspector as he turned a page in his notebook. "A Mr. Stanley Tancock, who turns out to be one of your stevedores."
"Name ring a bell, sir?"
"Can't say it does," said Hugo. "But if he works in the yard, he would certainly have known where my office was."
"I am in no doubt, sir, that Tancock knew where your office was, because he says he came to see you around 7 yesterday evening to tell you that his brother-in-law, a Mr. Arthur Clifton, was trapped in the hull of a ship being built in the yard, and if you didn't give the order to get him out, he would die."
"Ah, yes. I remember now. I did go over to the yard yesterday afternoon, as my ganger will confirm, but it turned out to be a false alarm and a waste of everyone's time. Clearly he just wanted to find out where the safe was so he could come back later and rob me."
"He admits that he came back to your office a second time," said Blakemore, turning another page of his notes, "when he claims you offered him £68.10 if he would keep his mouth shut about Clifton."
"I've never heard such an outrageous suggestion."
"Then let us consider the alternative for a moment, sir. Let us suppose that Tancock did come back to your office with the intention of robbing you sometime between 7 o'clock and 7:30 yesterday evening. Having somehow managed to get into the building unobserved, he reaches the 5th floor, makes his way to your office, and with either your key or Miss Potts's, unlocks the safe, enters the code, removes the envelope, slits it neatly open, and takes out the money, but doesn't bother with a box of gold coins. He leaves the safe door open, spreads some of its contents on the floor, and places the neatly opened envelope on your desk, and then, like the Scarlet Pimpernel, disappears into thin air.
It needn't have been between 7 and 7:30 in the evening," said Hugo defiantly. "It could have been any time before 8 this morning."
"I think not, sir," said Blakemore. "You see, Tancock has an alibi between 8 and 11 o'clock last night."
"No doubt this so-called alibi is some mate of his," said Barrington.
31 of them, at the last count," said the detective inspector. "It seems that having stolen your money, he turned up at the Pig and Whistle public house at around 8 o'clock, and not only were the drinks on him, but he also cleared his slate. He paid the landlord with a new £5 note, which I have in my possession." The detective removed his wallet, took out the note, and placed it on Barrington's desk. The landlord also added that Tancock left the pub at around 11, and was so drunk that two of his friends had to accompany him to his home in Stillhouse Lane, where we found him this morning. I am bound to say, sir, that if it was Tancock who robbed you, we have a master criminal on our hands, and I'd be proud to be the man who puts him behind bars, which I suspect is exactly what you had in mind, sir," he added, looking directly at Barrington, "when you gave him the money."
"And why on earth would I do that?"
said Hugo, trying to keep his voice even. "Because if Stanley Tancock was arrested and sent to jail, no one would take his story about Arthur Clifton seriously. Incidentally, Clifton hasn't been seen since yesterday afternoon, so I shall be recommending to my superiors that the hull be opened up without further delay, so that we can discover if it was a false alarm, and Tancock was wasting everyone's time." Hugo Barrington checked in the mirror and straightened his bow tie. He He hadn't told his father about the Arthur Clifton incident or the visit from Detective Inspector Blakemore. The less the old man knew, the better. All he'd said was that some money had been stolen from his office and one of the stevedores had been arrested. Once he'd put on his dinner jacket, Hugo sat on the end of the bed and waited for his wife to finish dressing. He hated being late, but he knew that no amount of badgering would make Elizabeth move any faster. He'd checked on Giles and his baby sister Emma, who were both fast asleep. Hugo had wanted two sons, an heir and a spare. Emma was an inconvenience, which meant he'd have to try again. His father had been a second child and lost his older brother fighting the Boers in South Africa. Hugo's older brother had been killed at Ypres, along with half his regiment. So in time, Hugo could expect to succeed his father as chairman of the company, and when his father died, to inherit the title and the family fortune. So he and Elizabeth would have to try again. Not that making love to his wife was a pleasure any more. In fact, he couldn't remember if it ever had been. Recently, he'd been looking for distractions elsewhere. "Yours is a marriage made in heaven," his mother used to say. His father was more practical. He had felt that bringing together his elder son and the only daughter of Lord Harvey was more of a merger than a marriage. When Hugo's brother was killed on the Western Front, his fiancée was passed on to Hugo. No longer a merger, more of a takeover. Hugo wasn't surprised to discover on his wedding night that Elizabeth was a virgin. His second virgin, in fact. Elizabeth finally emerged from the dressing room, apologizing, as she always did, for keeping him waiting. The journey from the manor house to Barrington Hall was only a couple of miles, and all the land in between the two houses belonged to the family. By the time Hugo and Elizabeth entered his parents' drawing room at a few minutes past eight, Lord Harvey was already on his second sherry. Hugo glanced around the room at the other guests. There was only one couple he didn't recognize. His father immediately took him across and introduced him to Colonel Danvers, the recently appointed chief constable of the county. Hugo decided not to mention his meeting that morning with Detective Inspector Blakemore to the colonel, but just before they sat down for dinner, he took his father on one side to bring him up to date on the theft, never once mentioning the name of Arthur Clifton. Over a dinner of game soup, succulent lamb and green beans, followed by creme brulee, the conversation ranged from the Prince of Wales's visit to Cardiff and his less than helpful remarks about sympathizing with the mine workers, to Lloyd George's latest import tariffs and the effect they would have on the shipping industry, Winston Churchill's speech in the Commons warning his fellow members about German rearmament, and George Bernard Shaw's Heartbreak House, which had recently opened to mixed reviews at the Old Vic Theatre, before returning to the Prince of Wales and the vexed question of how to find him a suitable wife. When the servants had cleared the table after dessert, the ladies retired to the drawing-room to enjoy coffee, while the butler offered the gentlemen brandy or port. "Shipped by me and imported by you," said Sir Walter, raising a glass to Lord Harvey, while the butler circled the table offering cigars to the guests. Once Lord Harvey's Romeo e Giulietta had been lit to his satisfaction, he turned to his son-in-law and said, "Your father tells me that some blighter broke into your office and stole a large amount of cash." "Yes, that's correct," Hugo replied. "But I'm pleased to say they've caught the thief. Sadly, he turned out to be one of our stevedores." "Is that right, Danvers?" asked Sir Walter. "You've caught the man?" "I did hear something about it," responded the chief constable, "but I wasn't told that anybody had been charged yet." "Why not?" demanded Lord Harvey. "Because the man is saying that I gave him the money," Hugo interjected. "In fact, when the detective inspector questioned me this morning, I began to wonder which one of us was the criminal and which the injured party.
"I'm sorry to hear you feel that way," said Colonel Danvers. "May I ask who the officer in charge of the investigation was?"
"Detective Inspector Blakemore," said Hugo, before adding, "I got the impression he might have a grudge against our family."
"When you employ as many people as we do," said Sir Walter, placing his glass back on the table, "there's bound to be the odd person who bears a grudge."
"I must admit," said Danvers, "that Blakemore's not known for his tact. But I'll look into the matter, and if I feel he's overstepped the mark, I'll assign someone else to the case."
Chapter 22 "School days are the happiest days of your life," claimed R.C. Sheriff. But that had not been Hugo Barrington's experience. Although he had a feeling that Giles would, as his father put it, make a better fist of things. Hugo tried to forget what had happened on his first day at school some 24 years ago. He'd been driven to St. Bede's in a handsome carriage, accompanied by his father, mother, and elder brother Nicholas, who had just been appointed school captain. Hugo had burst into tears when another new bug had innocently asked, "Is it true your grandfather was a docker?" Sir Walter was proud his father had pulled himself up by his bootstraps. But with 8-year-olds, first impressions stick. "Grandpa was a docker, grandpa was a docker, cry baby," chanted the rest of the dorm. Today, his son Giles would be driven to St. Bede's in Sir Walter Barrington's Rolls Royce. Hugo had wanted to take his son to school in his own car, but his father wouldn't hear of it. 3 generations of Barringtons have been educated at St. Bede's and Eton. My heir must arrive in style. Hugo didn't point out to his father that Giles hadn't, as yet, been offered a place at Eton, and that it was even possible the boy might have ideas of his own as to where he would like to be educated. "Heaven forbid," he could hear his father saying. "Ideas smack of rebellion, and rebellions must be put down." Giles hadn't spoken since they'd left the house, although his mother hadn't stopped fussing over her only son for the past hour. Emma had started to sob when she was told she couldn't accompany them, while Grace, another girl, he wouldn't bother to try again, just clung on to Nanny's hand and waved from the top step as they drove away. Hugo had other things than the family's female line on his mind as the car manoeuvred its way slowly through the country lanes towards the city. Was he about to see Harry Clifton for the first time? Would he recognize him as the other son he'd wanted but would never have, or would he be left in no doubt the moment he saw the boy that he couldn't be his kinsman? Hugo would have to be careful to avoid Clifton's mother. Would he even recognize her? He'd recently discovered that she was working as a waitress in the Palm Court room at the Royal Hotel, which he used to frequent whenever he had business meetings in the city. Now he would have to confine himself to the occasional visit in the evening, and then only if he was certain she'd left for the day. Maisie's brother, Stan Tancock, had been released from prison after serving 18 months of his 3-year sentence. Hugo never did find out what had happened to Detective Inspector Blakemore, but he never saw the man again following his father's dinner party. A young detective sergeant gave evidence at Tancock's trial, and he clearly wasn't in any doubt who the guilty party was. Once Tancock was safely behind bars, speculation about what had happened to Arthur Clifton quickly dried up. In a business where death is commonplace, Arthur Clifton became just another statistic. However, when Lady Harvey launched the Maple Leaf 6 months later, Hugo couldn't help thinking that Davy Jones Locker would have been a more appropriate name for the vessel. When the final figures were presented to the board, Barrington's ended up showing a loss of £13,712 on the project.
Hugo didn't suggest that they tender for any more shipbuilding contracts in the future, and Sir Walter never referred to the subject again. In the years that followed, Barrington's returned to its traditional business as a shipping line and continued to go from strength to strength. After Stan had been carted off to the local prison, Hugo had assumed that would be the last he heard of him. But shortly before Tancock was due to be released, the deputy governor of HMP Bristol rang Miss Potts and asked for an appointment. When they met, the deputy governor pleaded with Barrington to give Tancock his old job back, otherwise he would have little hope of ever being employed again. At first, Hugo was delighted to hear this piece of news, but after giving the matter some thought, changed his mind and dispatched Phil Haskins, his chief ganger, to visit Tancock in prison and tell him he could have his job back on one condition. He was never to mention the name of Arthur Clifton again. If he did, he could collect his cards and look for work elsewhere. Tancock had accepted the offer gratefully, and as the years passed, it became clear that he had kept his side of the bargain. The Rolls-Royce drew up outside the front gate of St. Bede's, and the chauffeur leapt out to open the back door. Several pairs of eyes turned to look in their direction, some with admiration, others with envy. Giles clearly didn't enjoy the attention, and quickly walked away, disowning the chauffeur as well as his parents. His mother chased after him, bent down and pulled his socks up, before giving his fingernails one last inspection. Hugo spent his time looking into the faces of countless children, wondering if he would instantly recognize someone he'd never seen before. And then he saw a boy walking up the hill, unaccompanied by a mother or father. He looked past the boy to see a woman watching him, a woman he could never forget. Both of them must have been wondering if he had one son or two reporting for their first day at St. Bede's. When Giles caught chickenpox and had to spend a few days in the sanatorium, his father realized this might be his chance to prove that Harry Clifton wasn't his son. He didn't tell Elizabeth he was going to visit Giles while he was in the San, as he didn't want her around when he asked Matron a seemingly innocuous question. Once he'd dealt with the Morning Post, Hugo told Miss Potts that he would be popping into St. Bede's to see his son, and she shouldn't expect him back for at least a couple of hours. He drove into the city and parked outside Frobisher House. He remembered only too well where the San was, as he'd had to visit it regularly when he was at St. Bede's. Giles was sitting up in bed, having his temperature taken, when his father strode into the room. The boy's face lit up the moment he saw him. Matron was standing by the bed, checking her patient's temperature. "Down to 99. We'll have you back in time for the first lesson on Monday morning, young man," she declared, as she shook the thermometer. "I'll leave you now, Mr. Barrington, so you can spend a little time with your son." "Thank you, Matron," said Hugo. "I wonder if I might have a word with you before I leave." "Of course, Mr. Barrington. You'll find me in my office." "You don't look too bad to me, Giles," said Hugo, once Matron had left the room. "I'm fine, Papa. In fact, I was rather hoping Matron would let me out on Saturday morning so I can play football. I'll have a word with her before I go." "Thank you, Papa. So, how's the work coming along?"
"Not bad," said Giles, "but that's only because I share a study with the two brightest boys in my class."
"And who are they?" asked his father, dreading the reply.
"There's Deacons. He's the cleverest boy in the school. In fact, the other boys won't even talk to him because they think he's a swot. But my best friend is Harry Clifton. He's very clever, too, but not as clever as Deacons. You've probably heard him singing in the choir. I know you'll like him."
"But isn't Clifton the son of a stevedore?" Hugo said.
"Yes, and just like Grandpa, he doesn't hide the fact.
But how did you know that, Papa?
I think Clifton used to work for the company, Hugo said, immediately regretting his words.
It must have been before your time, Papa, said Giles, because his father was killed in the war.
Who told you that? Said Hugo.
Harry's mother. She's a waitress at the Royal Hotel. We went to tea there on his birthday.
Hugo would have liked to have asked when Clifton's birthday was, but feared it might be one question too many. Instead, he said,
Your mother sends her love. I think she and Emma plan to visit you later this week.
Yuck, that's all I need, said Giles.
Chicken pox and a visit from my dreadful sister.
She's not that bad, said his father, laughing.
She's worse, said Giles, and Grace doesn't look as if she's going to be any better.
Do they have to come on holiday with us, Papa?
Yes, of course they do.
I was wondering if Harry Clifton could join us in Tuscany this summer. He's never been abroad.
No, said Hugo, a little too firmly. Holidays are strictly for the family, not to be shared with strangers.
But he's not a stranger, said Giles. He's my best friend.
No, Hugo repeated, and that's an end of the matter.
Giles looked disappointed.
So what would you like for your birthday, my boy?
Hugo asked, quickly changing the subject.
The latest radio, said Giles, without hesitation. It's called a Roberts Reliable.
Are you allowed to have radios at school?
Yes, said Giles, but you can only play them at weekends.
If you're caught listening after lights out or during the week, they get confiscated.
I'll see what I can do.
Will you be coming home on your birthday?
Yes, but only for tea. I have to be back at school in time for prep.
Then I'll try and drop in, said Hugo.
I'll be off now. I want a word with Matron before I leave.
Don't forget to ask her if she'll let me out on Saturday morning, Giles reminded him as his father left the room to carry out the real purpose of his visit.
I'm so glad you were able to drop by, Mr. Barrington. It will perk Giles up no end, said Matron as he walked into her office. But as you can see, he's almost fully recovered.
Yes, and he's hoping you'll let him out on Saturday morning so he can play in a football match.
I'm sure that will be possible, said Matron. But you said there was something else you wanted to talk about.
Yes, Matron. As you know, Giles is colorblind. I just wanted to ask if it was causing him any difficulties.
Not that I'm aware of, said Matron. If it is, it certainly doesn't stop him hitting a red ball across a green field until it reaches a white boundary.
Barrington laughed before he delivered his next well-prepared line.
When I was at St. Bede's, I used to be teased because I was the only boy who suffered from color blindness.
Let me assure you, said Matron, no one teases Giles. And in any case, his best friend is also colorblind.
Hugo drove back to his office, thinking that something had to be done before the situation got out of control. He decided to have another word with Colonel Danvers. Once he was back behind his desk, he told Miss Potts he didn't want to be disturbed. He waited until she'd closed the door before he picked up the telephone. A few moments later, the chief constable was on the line.
"It's Hugo Barrington, Colonel."
"How are you, my boy?" asked the chief constable.
"I'm well, sir. I was wondering if you could advise me on a private matter."
"Fire away, old fellow."
"I'm looking for a new head of security, and I wondered if you might be able to point me in the right direction."
"As a matter of fact, I do know a man who might fit the bill, but I'm not sure if he's still available. I'll find out and give you a call back."
The chief constable was as good as his word, and phoned back the following morning.
"The man I had in mind has a part-time job at the moment, but he's looking for something more permanent."
"What can you tell me about him?" asked Hugo.
"He was being groomed for higher things in the force, but he had to leave when he was badly injured trying to apprehend a robber during a raid on the Midland Bank. You probably remember the story. It even hit the national press. In my opinion, he'd be the ideal candidate to head your security team, and frankly, you'd be lucky to get him. If you're still interested, I could drop you a line with his details." Barrington rang Derek Mitchell from his home, as he didn't want Miss Potts to find out what he was up to. He agreed to meet the former policeman at the Royal Hotel at 6 o'clock on Monday evening, after Mrs. Clifton would have left for the day and the Palm Court would be empty. Hugo arrived a few minutes early and headed straight for a table at the far end of the room that he wouldn't normally have considered. He took a seat behind the pillar, where he knew his meeting with Mitchell would not be seen or overheard. While he waited, he went over a list of questions in his mind that needed answering if he was going to put his trust in a complete stranger. At 6:03, a tall, well-built man of military bearing pushed his way through the revolving doors. His dark navy blazer, grey flannels, short hair and highly polished shoes all suggested a life of discipline. Hugo stood and raised a hand as if he was summoning a waiter. Mitchell walked slowly across the room, making no attempt to disguise a slight limp, an injury which, according to Danvers, was the reason Mitchell had been invalided out of the police service. Hugo recalled the last occasion he'd come face to face with a police officer, but this time he would be asking the questions.
"Good evening, sir."
"Good evening, Mitchell," said Hugo as they shook hands. Once Mitchell had sat down, Hugo took a closer look at his broken nose and cauliflower ears, and also recalled from Colonel Danvers's notes that he used to play in the second row for Bristol.
"Let me say from the outset, Mitchell," said Hugo, not wasting any time, "that what I want to discuss with you is of a highly confidential nature, and must be kept strictly between the two of us."
Mitchell nodded. "It is so confidential, in fact, that even Colonel Danvers has no idea of the real reason I needed to see you, as I am certainly not looking for someone to head up my security operation." Mitchell's face remained inscrutable as he waited to hear what Hugo had in mind. "I'm looking for someone to act as a private detective. His sole purpose will be to report to me each month on the activities of a woman who lives in this city and, in fact, works in this hotel."
"I understand, sir."
"I want to know everything she gets up to, whether professional or personal, however insignificant it might seem. She must never, I repeat, never become aware of your interest in her. So before I reveal her name, do you consider yourself capable of carrying out such an assignment?"
"These things are never easy," said Mitchell, "but they're not impossible. As a young detective sergeant, I worked on an undercover operation which resulted in a particularly loathsome individual ending up behind bars for 16 years. If he were to walk into this hotel now, I'm confident he wouldn't recognize me."
Hugo smiled for the first time. "Before I go any further," he continued, "I need to know if you would be willing to take on such an assignment."
"That would depend on several things, sir."
"Such as?"
"Would it be a full-time position? Because I currently have a night security job working for a bank."
"Hand in your notice tomorrow," said Hugo. "I don't want you to be working for anyone else."
"And what are the hours?"
"At your discretion."
"And my salary?"
"I will pay you £8 a week, a month in advance, and will also cover any legitimate expenses."
Mitchell nodded.
"May I suggest you make any payments in cash, sir, so that nothing can be traced back to you?"
"That seems sensible," said Hugo, who'd already made that decision.
"And would you want the monthly reports to be in writing or in person?"
"In person. I want as little committed to paper as possible."
"Then we should always meet at a different location, and never on the same day of the week. That way it would be unlikely that anyone would come across us more than once."
"I have no problem with that," said Hugo.
"When would you want me to start, sir?"
"You started 30 minutes ago, said Barrington.
He He removed a slip of paper and an envelope containing £32 from an inside pocket and handed them to Mitchell. Mitchell studied the name and address written on the piece of paper for a few moments before handing it back to his new boss.
"I'll also need your private number, sir, and details of when and where you can be contacted."
"At my office any evening between 5 and 6, said Hugo. "You must never contact me at home, unless it's an emergency," he added, as he took out a pen.
"Just tell me the numbers, sir. Don't write them down."
Chapter 23 "Were you thinking of attending Master Giles's birthday party?" asked Miss Potts. Hugo looked at his diary. "Giles, 12th birthday, 3 p.m., Manor House," was written in bold letters at the top of the page. "Do I have time to pick up a present on the way home?" Miss Potts left the room and returned a moment later carrying a large parcel wrapped in shiny red paper and tied with a ribbon. "What's inside?" asked Hugo. "The latest Roberts radio, the one he asked for when you visited him in the sand last month." "Thank you, Miss Potts," said Hugo. He checked his watch. "I'd better leave now if I'm going to be in time to see him cut the cake." Miss Potts placed a thick file in his briefcase, and before he could ask, she said, "Your background notes for tomorrow morning's board meeting. You can go over them after Master Giles has returned to St. Bede's. That way there will be no need for you to come back this evening." "Thank you, Miss Potts," said Hugo. "You think of everything." As he drove through the city on his way home, Hugo couldn't help noticing how many more cars there seemed to be on the highway than there had been a year ago. Pedestrians were becoming more wary of casually crossing the road since the government had increased the speed limit to 30 miles per hour. A horse reared up as Hugo shot past a hansom cab. He wondered how much longer they could hope to survive now that the city council had authorized its first taxicab. Once he had driven out of the city, Hugo sped up, not wanting to be late for his son's party. How quickly the boy was growing. He was already taller than his mother. Would he end up taller than his father? When Giles left St. Bede's and took up his place at Eton in a year's time, Hugo felt confident that his friendship with the Clifton boy would soon be forgotten, although he realized there were other difficulties that needed to be addressed before then. He slowed down as he passed through the gates of his estate. He always enjoyed the long drive through the avenue of oaks up to the manor house. Jenkins was standing on the top step as Hugo got out of the car. He held open the front door and said, "Mrs. Barrington is in the drawing room, sir, with Master Giles and two of his school friends." As he walked into the hall, Emma came running down the stairs and threw her arms around her father. "What's in the parcel?" she demanded. "A birthday present for your brother." "Yes, but what is it?" "You'll have to wait and see, young lady," said her father with a smile before he handed his briefcase to the butler. "Would you put that in my study, Jenkins?" he said, as Emma grabbed him by the hand and began to tug him towards the drawing room. Hugo's smile evaporated the moment he opened the door and saw who was sitting on the sofa. Giles leapt up and ran towards his father, who handed him the parcel and said, "Happy birthday, my boy." "Thank you, Papa," he said, before introducing his friends. Hugo shook Deacon's hand, but when Harry offered his, he just said, "Good afternoon, Clifton," and sat down in his favourite chair. Hugo watched with interest as Giles undid the ribbon on his parcel, and they both saw the present for the first time. Even his son's unbridled delight with his new radio didn't bring a smile to Hugo's lips. He had a question that he needed to ask Clifton, but it mustn't appear as if the boy's reply was of any significance. He remained silent while the three boys took turns, tuning into the two stations and listening intently to the strange voices and music that came out of the speaker. This was regularly followed by laughter or applause. Mrs. Barrington chatted to Harry about a recent concert of the Messiah she'd attended, adding how much she'd enjoyed his rendition of I Know That My Redeemer Liveth.
"Thank you, Mrs. Barrington," said Harry.
"Are you hoping to go on to Bristol Grammar School after you leave St. Bede's, Clifton?" asked Hugo, spotting an opening.
"Only if I win a scholarship, sir," he replied.
"But why is that important?" asked Mrs. Barrington. "Surely you would be offered a place like any other boy."
"Because my mother wouldn't be able to afford the fees, Mrs. Barrington. She's a waitress at the Royal Hotel."
"But wouldn't your father—"
"He's dead," said Harry. "He was killed in the war."
"I'm sorry," said Mrs. Barrington. "I didn't realize."
At that moment the door opened, and the under-butler entered the room, carrying a large cake on a silver tray. After Giles had succeeded in blowing out all 12 candles with one puff, everyone applauded.
"And when's your birthday, Clifton?" asked Hugo.
"It was last month, sir," Harry replied.
After Giles had cut the cake, Hugo stood up and left the room without another word. He went straight to his study, but found he couldn't concentrate on his papers for the next day's board meeting. Clifton's reply meant he would have to seek advice from a lawyer who specialized in the law of heredity. After an hour or so, he heard voices in the hall, then the front door closing and the sound of a car driving away. A few minutes later there was a knock on his study door, and Elizabeth walked in.
"What made you leave us so abruptly?" she asked. "And why didn't you come and say goodbye, when you must have known Giles and his guests were leaving?"
"I have a very tricky board meeting tomorrow morning," he said, without looking up.
"That's no reason not to say goodbye to your son, especially on his birthday." "I've got a lot on my mind," he said, still looking down at his notes.
"Surely nothing is so important that you need to be rude to guests. You are more offhand with Harry Clifton than you would be with one of the servants."
Hugo looked up for the first time.
"That's possibly because I consider Clifton inferior to our servants."
Elizabeth looked shocked.
"Did you know that his father was a dock labourer and his mother is a waitress? I'm not sure that's the sort of boy Giles should be mixing with."
"Giles clearly thinks otherwise, and whatever his background, Harry's a charming boy. I can't understand why you're so against him. You didn't treat Deakins that way, and his father's a newsagent."
"He's also an open scholar."
"And Harry is the school's prize choral scholar, as every church-going citizen in Bristol knows. Next time you come across him, I hope you'll be a little more civil."
Without another word, Elizabeth left the room, closing the door firmly behind her.
Sir Walter Barrington remained in his place at the head of the boardroom table as his son entered the room.
"I'm becoming increasingly concerned about the government's proposed legislation on import tariffs," said Hugo, as he took a seat on the right of his father, "and the effect it might have on our balance sheet."
"That's why we have a lawyer on the board," said Sir Walter, "so that he can advise us on such matters. But I've calculated that it could cost us £20,000 a year if it becomes law. Don't you think we ought to seek a second opinion?"
"I suppose I could have a word with Sir James Amherst when I'm next in London."
"I'm travelling up to London on Tuesday for the Association of British Shipowners' annual dinner," said Hugo. "As he's the industry's legal adviser, perhaps I should have a word with him."
"Only if you're convinced it's necessary," said Sir Walter.
"And don't forget that Amherst charges by the hour, even at dinner."
The Association of British Shipowners' Dinner was held at the Grosvenor House and was attended by over 1,000 members and their guests. Hugo had earlier phoned the Association's secretary and asked if he could be seated next to Sir James Amherst. The secretary raised an eyebrow, but agreed to rearrange the guests on the top table. After all,
old Joshua Barrington had been a founder member of the association. After the Bishop of Newcastle had said grace, Hugo made no attempt to interrupt the eminent Silk while he was deep in conversation with the man on his right. However, when the lawyer finally turned his attention to the stranger they'd put on his left, Hugo didn't waste any time in getting to the point. "My father, Sir Walter Barrington," he began, capturing his quarry's attention, "is rather concerned about the import tariff bill that is going through the House of Commons and the effect it might have on the industry. He wonders if he could consult you on the subject when he's next in London." "By all means, dear boy," said Sir James. "Just ask his secretary to give my clerk a call, and I'll make sure I'm free when he's next in town." "Thank you, sir," said Hugo. "On a lighter note, I wondered if you'd ever read anything by Agatha Christie."
"Can't say I have," said Sir James. "Is she any good?"
"I'm much enjoying her latest book, Where There's a Will," said Hugo, "but I'm not sure if the plot would stand up in a court of law."
"What's the lady suggesting?"
asked Amherst, as a sliver of overcooked beef served on a cold plate was placed in front of him. "According to Miss Christie, the eldest son of an hereditary knight automatically inherits his father's title, even if the child is illegitimate."
"Ah, now, that is indeed an interesting legal conundrum," said Sir James. "In fact, the law lords have quite recently reviewed such a case. Benson v. Carstairs, if I remember correctly. It's often referred to by the press as the Bastards Amendment."
"And what conclusion did their lordships come to?" asked Hugo, trying not to sound too interested.
"If no loophole could be found in the original will, they came out in favour of the firstborn, even if the young man in question was illegitimate."
Another answer Hugo hadn't wanted to hear.
"However," Sir James continued, "their lordships decided to cover their backsides and added a codicil that each case should be treated on its own merits, and then only after it had been reviewed by the Garter King of Arms. Typical of the law lords," he added, before picking up his knife and fork and attacking the beef, "too frightened to set a precedent, but quite happy to pass the buck."
When Sir James returned his attention to the man on his right, Hugo thought about the implications of Harry Clifton discovering that he might have the right to inherit not only the Barrington shipping line, but also the family estate. Having to admit he had sired an illegitimate son would be bad enough, but the idea of Harry Clifton inheriting the family title after his death and becoming Sir Harry did not bear thinking about. He would be willing to do anything in his power to make sure that wouldn't be the outcome. Chapter 24. Hugo Barrington was having breakfast when he read the letter from the headmaster of St. Bede's outlining the details of an appeal the school was launching to raise £1,000 to build a new cricket pavilion for the first 11. He opened his checkbook and had written the figures 100, when he was distracted by the sound of a car coming to a halt on the gravel outside. Hugo walked across to the window to see who could possibly be visiting him so early on a Saturday morning. He was puzzled when he saw his son step out of the back of a taxi carrying a suitcase. As he'd been looking forward to watching him open the batting for the school that afternoon in the final match of the season against Avonhurst. Jenkins appeared just in time to open the front door as Giles reached the top step. "Good morning, Master Giles," he said, as if he'd been expecting him. Hugo walked quickly out of the breakfast room to find his son standing in the hall, head bowed, suitcase by his side. "What are you doing at home?" he asked. "Isn't there another week to go before the end of term?" "I've been rusticated," said Giles simply.
"Rusticated?" repeated his father.
"And what have you done to merit that, may I ask?" Giles looked up at Jenkins,
who stood silently by the front door. "I'll take Master Giles's suitcase up to his bedroom," the butler said, before picking up the bag and proceeding slowly up the stairs.
"Follow me," said Hugo, once the butler was out of sight.
Neither of them spoke again until Hugo had closed the study door behind him.
"What have you done to cause the school to take such a drastic measure?" demanded his father as he sank back into his chair.
"I was caught stealing from the tuck shop," said Giles, who had been left standing in the middle of the room.
"Is there some simple explanation? A misunderstanding, perhaps?"
"No, there isn't, sir," said Giles, fighting back tears.
"Do you have anything to say in your defence?"
"No, sir," Giles hesitated. "Except—"
"Except what?"
"I always gave the sweets away, Papa. I never kept them for myself."
"To Clifton, no doubt."
"And to Deakins as well," said Giles.
"Was it Clifton who put you up to it in the first place?"
"No, it was not," responded Giles firmly. "In fact, once he found out what I'd been up to, Harry always took the sweets I gave him and Deakins back to the tuck shop. He even took the blame when Mr. Frobisher accused him of stealing them."
A long silence followed before his father said, "So you've been rusticated, not actually expelled?"
Giles nodded.
"You think they will allow you to go back next term?"
"I doubt it," said Giles.
"What makes you so sure of that?"
"Because I've never seen the headmaster so angry."
"Not half as angry as your mother will be when she finds out."
"Please don't tell her, Papa,"
pleaded Giles, bursting into tears. "And how do you expect me to explain to her why you're home a week early and might not even be returning to St. Bede's next term?"
Giles made no attempt to respond, but continued to sob quietly.
"And heaven knows what your grandparents will say," his father added, "when I have to tell them why you won't be going to Eton after all."
Another long silence followed.
"Go to your room, and don't even think about coming back down until I say so."
"Yes, sir," said Giles. He turned to leave.
"And whatever you do, don't discuss this with anyone, especially not in front of the servants."
"Yes, Papa,"
said Giles, who ran out of the room, nearly colliding with Jenkins as he shot past him on the stairs.
Hugo leant forward in his chair, trying to think if there might be some way to turn the situation around before he had to face an inevitable call from the headmaster. He placed his elbows on the desk and his head in his hands, but it was some time before his eyes focused on the check. A smile crossed his lips as he added an extra naught before signing it.
Chapter 25. Mitchell was seated in the far corner of the waiting room, reading the Bristol Evening Post, when Hugo walked across and sat down beside him. It was so draughty that Hugo kept his hands in his pockets.
"The subject," said Mitchell, still looking at his newspaper, "is trying to raise £500 for a business venture."
"What sort of business venture could she possibly be interested in?"
"Tilly's Tea Shop," replied Mitchell. "It seems the subject worked there before she moved to the Palm Court Room at the Royal. Miss Tilly has recently had an offer of £500 for the business from a Mr. Edward Atkins. Miss Tilly doesn't care for Atkins, and has made it clear to the subject that if she were able to raise the same amount, she would prefer her to take over the business."
"Where could she possibly hope to get hold of that much money?"
"Perhaps from someone who wished to have financial control over her, which might at a later date prove advantageous."
Hugo remained silent. Mitchell's eyes never left his paper.
"Has she approached anyone to try and raise the money?" Hugo eventually asked. "She's currently taking advice
from a Mr. Patrick Casey, who represents Dillon & Co., a finance company based in Dublin. They specialize in raising loans for private clients.
How do I get in touch with Casey?
I wouldn't advise that, said Mitchell.
Why not?
He visits Bristol about once a month and always stays at the Royal.
We wouldn't have to meet at the Royal.
He has struck up a close personal relationship with the subject. Whenever he's in town, he takes her to dinner or the theatre, and recently she's been seen returning with him to the hotel where they spend the night together, in room 371.
Fascinating, said Hugo. Anything else?
It may also interest you to know that the subject banks with the National Provincial, 49 Corn Street. The manager is a Mr. Prendergast. Her current account is showing a balance of £12.09.
Hugo would like to have asked how Mitchell had come across that particular piece of information, but satisfied himself with saying, Excellent. The moment you come up with anything else, however insignificant, ring me.
He took a bulky envelope from his overcoat pocket and slipped it across to Mitchell.
The train now arriving at Platform 9 is the 7:22 from Taunton.
Mitchell pocketed the envelope, folded his newspaper, and walked out of the waiting room. He'd never once looked at his employer.
Hugo had been unable to hide his anger when he discovered the real reason Giles had failed to be offered a place at Eton. He'd phoned the headmaster, who refused to take his calls, his prospective housemaster, who sympathized but offered no hope of redemption, and even the provost, who said he'd call back but didn't. Although Elizabeth and the girls had no idea what had caused Hugo to so regularly lose his temper of late, and for no apparent reason, they continued to bear the brunt of Giles's misdemeanors with equanimity. Hugo reluctantly accompanied Giles to Bristol Grammar School on his first day of term, although he wouldn't allow either Emma or Grace to join them, despite Emma bursting into tears and sulking. When Hugo brought the car to a halt in College Street, the first person he saw standing outside the school gates was Harry Clifton. Even before he pulled on the brake, Giles had leapt out and run across to greet his friend. Hugo avoided mingling with the other parents, whom Elizabeth seemed quite happy to chat to, and when he inadvertently came across Clifton, he made a point of not shaking hands with him. On the journey back to the manor house, Elizabeth asked her husband why he treated Giles's best friend with such disdain. Hugo reminded his wife that their son should have gone to